Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. If you can imagine a world where your fridge notices you're out of yogurt and automatically places an order for more, where wearable devices allow you to track your health and fitness and your kids' whereabouts, and where DNA identification means we have to carry around fewer badges and keys and documents, you might also be able to imagine how these things could go terribly wrong if bad people take over. For every miraculous convenience of our digitally connected world, there is also a potential for mayhem, theft, loss of privacy, even terrorism. My guest has built a career on understanding tech crimes as they exist today and as they are likely to shake out in the future, in hopes of helping individuals, businesses, and governments protect against them. Mark Goodman is founder of the Future Crimes Institute and has worked as a police officer, senior advisor to Interpol, and futurist in residence for the FBI. His new book is called Future Crimes: Everything is Connected, Everyone is Vulnerable, and What We Can Do About It. Mark, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much, Chris.
You tell an amusing story at the beginning of the book of how you first got into this specialization as a police officer. You basically qualified because you knew how to use spell check. But just like the criminals, over time, you've had to quickly ramp up your knowledge.
Absolutely. You know, that story that you just referenced, I was working as a detective with the Los Angeles Police Department as an investigator. And one day my lieutenant bellowed my name across the detective squad room. He said, "Goodman, get your butt over here." And I thought that I was in trouble. But turns out he asked me just that very question. "Hey, do you know how to spell check in Word Perfect?" And I said, "Sure, boss, Shift F2. And he got a big smile on his face and he said, "I knew you were a geek. I got a case for you." So back in those early days, knowing how to spell check put me among the techno elite of police officers. And I really had no skills or knowledge on how to investigate those cases, but we had to teach ourselves and learn. And as you rightly pointed out, the bad guys are running far, far ahead.
And certainly reading this book, Mark, it seems like the future of law enforcement will call for a very different skill set than it did in the past.
Right. If you think about what police officers or security personnel were back in the day, it was almost always based upon physical strength, prowess with a weapon, and the like. To be a police officer, we needed people who could fight and defend themselves and protect citizens, shoot good, you know how to use a baton. But none of those skill sets are directly required most of the time in investigating cybercrimes. It opens the opportunity to create a very different type of police force, and one that we need desperately is one that is technologically competent, because the criminals are using all different types of new tools, ranging from 3D printed weapons to artificial intelligence and even robotics.
And of course, you can have a victim in like Fort Worth, Texas, who has suffered real losses, and then you're looking for someone maybe a continent away. That there are so many challenges to finding that individual, but also to working across jurisdictions and all that.
Absolutely. If somebody is a victim of a cybercrime in Dallas-Fort Worth, the challenge is that a Dallas cop has absolutely no jurisdiction in Moscow or Kiev or in Lagos, Nigeria. In effect, the internet broke policing, right? It certainly works okay for local crimes. So if there's a bank robbery in Dallas, then we know that, okay, the criminal was in Dallas, the victim was in Dallas, the police who investigate it will be in Dallas, Dallas police and FBI. There'll be evidence left behind the scene. There may be DNA from when they jumped over the countertop, fingerprints, and photographs. And all of that breaks on the internet. We have this, you know, excellent system of nation states. That means that the United States can be sovereign and outside interference from other countries. And that's great. We love our liberty. But the flip side of that is that a New York City police officer or a Texas Ranger can't arrest somebody in another country. So we have a system of public policy, law enforcement, legal jurisdiction, mutual legal assistance, international law that are all highly dependent on cooperation and are all incredibly slow. So if you're looking as a local Dallas cop trying to get evidence out of Lagos or Russia, if it ever comes at all, it could take years to get that evidence, whereas the bad guys can change their IP address and throw away their computers in a matter of seconds.
Tell us about the dark web.
Well, most folks think they're on the internet. Most modern folks today think they're online because they use services like Google and Facebook and ESPN and Twitter. But what many don't understand is that there's a whole other internet out there, and that's called the deep web. And that deep web is the part of the internet that is separated from the rest, either because you need special software to get there or you need a special password. So companies like LexisNexis that will keep huge amounts of data in private proprietary databases, those university research databases, and even criminal databases are separated out from that general net. When most folks search Google, they don't realize that Google only indexes 16% of what's called the surface web, the ESPNs, the CNNs, NPRs, and the like, only 16%. And Google searches 0% of the dark web because they can't access it, which means that when you're doing a Google search, you're really only searching 0.03% of all of the information that's in digital format on our planet. And so bad guys like that. They like hiding, not just in the deep web, but in the dark web. And in that dark web, they can ply their trade, whether it be selling narcotics, hiring hitmen, trading in child pornography, stolen passports, whatever you want, you can find in the digital underground.
How do you, I don't want exact instructions, but how do you access this to sort of know what's going on out there? And how do other law enforcement professionals get there to just to monitor what sorts of things might be taking place?
Right. It's really difficult. You need specialized software. The most common one is something called Tor, which stands for the Onion Router. It's freely downloadable. And in fact, it was actually created by the U.S. government for a very good reason. The U.S. Department of the Navy created Tor, the Onion Router, this encrypted software, and gave it away to democracy and human rights activists overseas in places like China and Iran so that they could penetrate those national firewalls and communicate with the rest of the world. Perfectly legit purpose. But as it turns out, of course, criminals were Johnny on the spot and ready to go. And they took that ability to bypass firewalls to encrypt information, in other words, making it unreadable by anybody who didn't have the secret key. And now they can use it. And there's many developments on the dark web. It used to be very difficult to navigate around, but now they have wikis. In the same way we have Wikipedia, there are actually wikis that will list all the different drug dealers, where to go for cocaine, where to go for methamphetamine. If you're looking for particular types of child pornography, it will be broken down and available there. Hitmen, firearms, silencers, you know, firearms with the serial number shaved off, all of that will be there. Stolen passports, it's all there in these wikis. And they even have something called Grams, which is basically the Google of the dark web. This never existed until very recently. You could only go into one dark web chat room basically at a time. But now with Grams, you can search up to 20 different dark webs and actually do price comparison. So I want to buy cocaine from this guy. Oh, well, it's not, the price isn't very good. Or they actually have customer reviews where on one dark web like Atlantis, you can go ahead and rate your drug dealer just like you would on eBay.
I think the most disturbing thing I read about in your book, and believe me, this is saying something, is that there are human traffickers who are willing to set up the live stream of a sexual assault on a child for a paying audience.
Yeah, I really hate to discuss that because as I was writing and researching this book, obviously I came across a lot of disturbing things. And what you just mentioned was by far and away the deepest, darkest, most horrible thing that I uncovered. And I sort of described it as sort of Dante's, you know, nine circles of hell or whatever it was, so that as you descend to it, you know, many people, many teenagers may go ahead and steal a pirated movie or some, you know, a CD or all the tracks from a digital playlist. But that's one thing. But as you go deeper and deeper, and some people may purchase marijuana online, but as you go into those deep, dark corners of the internet, the deep recesses where the average person will thankfully never go, you can find really tremendously horrific events like the one you described. You can even traffic in human body parts. You can buy eyeballs and kidneys and other crazy things online.
I was thinking about the job of national security people who have to, you know, monitor terrorist traffic, among other things, and the potential for like an in-terrorist cell app that could be used for communication makes it harder than ever for them to sort of, you know, put their ear to the ground and listen for chatter.
Well, criminals are all over these tools, for sure, as are terrorists. If you go back to the first World Trade Center bombing back in the early 90s, the person who carried out that attack had evidence on his computer back, I think it was 91, 93. There was evidence on that computer back in those days, almost 25 years ago, that was encrypted. And the FBI could not read that national security information, even though this person was heavily implicated and ultimately convicted for carrying out that attack. So criminals and terrorists have been using encryption, which scrambles the text that people would otherwise want to read and prevents law enforcement from reading it. Now, I want to be really clear. There are every good reason why people might want to have access to encryption. And I think the good people should be free, clear access to their own papers in their own homes, as the Constitution does call for. But there are times when law enforcement and national security agencies, for reasons of national security, may have legitimate needs to get access to that data as a means of preventing a terrorist plot. And we're seeing that terrorists are getting much, much more sophisticated. I talked about the 2008 terrorist attack in Mumbai in Future Crimes. And if you recall that incident, you know, it lasted for 60 hours. Over 300 people were injured, more than 100 killed. And I was in India working with Interpol and got there the second day of that event. And I spent over a year studying it after the fact. And what we saw is one of the reasons why the terrorists were so effective was not just because they were using traditional, you know, kinetic weapons like explosives, hand grenades, AK-47s, but that they were also armed with satellite phones, Skype, Blackberries, night vision goggles, and they used those tools as well as a social media monitoring center to gather more and more intelligence on what the cops were doing, on what the government of India were doing, and in particular what individual citizens were using so that they could track them down and kill them.
So in the same way that we hear sometimes these triumphant stories in these chaotic situations of people communicating with these things, the criminals can use them too to bad effect.
100%. We even saw that in Boston during the Boston Marathon bombing, when police officers in SWAT formation were crawling around in a low crawl trying to get access to the two terrorists that carried out that attack. And members of the public, there was a great shot, I think it was in the Boston Globe, of like, you know, five different people on the third story of their window above the SWAT unit taking photos of them and tweeting it out in real time with GPS coordinates, which of course gives the bad guys situational awareness of what's going on. And the city of Boston actually had to put out an urgent tweet from the police department saying, please stop tweeting, live tweeting the movement of our officers. You're putting them and the public at risk for doing so.
So a corporation that wants to have a security expert, often, you know, money's no object and they will pay as much as it takes to get the very best. Law enforcement agencies are not known for having gigantic budgets, you know, of money just lying around. What are they doing about the need to hire incredibly qualified people who in the private sector could make 10 times as much?
It's definitely a challenge for law enforcement. Many, many years ago in Australia, they had trained up 10 different police specialists in Sydney, Australia. This is going back about 10 years. And they had been trained. They were working cybercrime cases. And one day, a large multinational consultancy came in, offered to double all of their salaries, and they all quit and went to go work at Deloitte instead. So it is definitely a challenge. And the government clearly faces challenges if you look at not just at the state and local level, but even at the federal level, how really abhorrent our federal cybersecurity is. But I do want to say that just because corporations have access to greater capital, it's not making them necessarily much safer, as we've seen recently in the hacks against Sony Entertainment Pictures, Home Depot, Target, Blue Cross, and any number of others.
We'll talk about those.
Money has to be spent wisely.
We'll talk about those in just a minute with Mark Goodman, who is founder of the Future Crimes Institute and author of the new book, Future Crimes. Everything is connected, everyone is vulnerable, and what we can do about it. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Mm-hmm.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can learn to draw and paint, how to speak French, or plan for your retirement. Courses start each week through spring. Registration and information is at smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Mark Goodman. He is founder of the Future Crimes Institute, has worked as a police officer, senior advisor to Interpol, and futurist in residence for the FBI. He has a new book out called Future Crimes. Everything is connected, everyone is vulnerable, and what we can do about it. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. One really interesting aspect of this, as you mentioned earlier, is that you can have situations in which governments are launching attacks against something like a private corporation, as we saw with the North Korea case in which Sony's accounts were hacked because of that movie, The Interview. What do we do about these sorts of things? On the one hand, it's a sort of private corporate crime. On the other hand, it's clearly an international incident.
Well, President Obama was asked this question himself. Both he and the director of the FBI came out and placed the blame on the Sony Entertainment Pictures attack on North Korea. I have not seen the classified data in that case, so I don't know what they may have seen that came to that conclusion. There certainly were many people of respect and repute that may have disputed that, and I think that even if North Korea were involved, there's definitely every chance that they had help from the inside or hackers elsewhere in the world. But it poses a real challenge. You know, I listened very carefully to President Obama, who said that in the wake of the Sony attack in November of last year, that we were going to get serious about cybersecurity and that he was going to be talking about it at his State of the Union address. And so I tuned in and listened intently to what the president was going to say. And he gave a State of the Union address that was 6,600 words. And of those 6,600 words, he called for things like greater information sharing and enhanced penalties for identity thieves. And I have to say, I was kind of disappointed, because if you think that increasing the penalty for identity thieves from 3 years to 6 years is going to solve this problem, I think it just fundamentally shows a misunderstanding of the breadth and depth of the problem. I wrote an op-ed actually on this, and I know that the president's a busy man and this is not partisan. He has a lot on his plate. But saying that enhancing penalties for identity thieves is going to stop other nation states from hacking us, or that it will protect our nation's critical information infrastructure, which are all run by computers, whether it be air traffic control, the electricity grid, 911 dispatch, hospital electronic records, right? It's all computerized. If you think, you know, enhanced penalties for identity thieves are going to solve that, we really don't really have a great grasp of the situation and the gravity of it. I said in my op-ed, you know, suggesting that enhanced penalties for identity thieves will protect us from these level of cyber threats is a little bit akin to putting sunscreen on your face and claiming that it will protect you from a nuclear blast, right? It's just wholly inappropriate for the scale and scope of the problem. So I think we need to get much more intentional. It was grand and amazing, great thinking that created the internet. That was a United States invention. We created that. Grand thinking created the internet, but small thinking won't save it. We need to get much, much more intentional. And that very first step is to admit how vulnerable we are, as I mentioned in Future Crimes, and then point out all the different steps we can take to improve our current situation.
So many people know by now that they shouldn't have a password that is like 123456, although, as you point out in the book, many people still are doing that and they have the same password for everything. But even the more complicated ones that we're encouraged to make up, with uppercase and lowercase and numerals and a special symbol, those are like surprisingly quick and easy to break if you've got the right technology.
They are. It looks like at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter if it's uppercase or lowercase. It comes down to one simple fact, which is how long is your password? The longer it is, the longer it will take to crack. And I forget the simple statistics, but it's something like a four-word password or four-digit password that most people might use to secure their iPhone could theoretically be cracked, you know, in just a couple of minutes, whereas a password that was 25 or 30 characters long, if you try to brute force attack that is trying a new password every second, if you try to brute force attack against a 30-digit password, it could take millions of years to go ahead and break that. So it's really a pain, right? The password, I start off telling the story of Matt Honan in Future Crimes. He was a reporter for Wired magazine, and we open up with Matt being hacked, and we see that slowly but surely he's sitting at home bouncing his two-year-old daughter off of his knee when he sees his iPhone suddenly powers down and restarts, and he thinks, wow, that's odd. So then he goes ahead and he sees the same thing happen to his iPad and then his computer, and when he reboots all of these devices, boom, all of his data was erased. And it was erased because somebody was able to get access to his password and reset it. And as a result of that, Matt, the Wired reporter, lost 8 years of all of his Gmail. He lost every photograph of his infant daughter from the time that she was born until her second birthday. And he even lost photographs of long-lost relatives who had passed on. And now those photographs were gone. So he said in a Wired article, Wired magazine article, and I fully agree, that the password is dead. It clearly does not work. What I recommend for people to do are two things when it comes to password management. We all have 20, 30, 40 passwords. It's way too much for any of us to remember, so we tend to use the same ones over and over. You can get something called a password manager. Reputable companies like Dashlane, 1Pass, LastPassword create these, and you can put passwords that are super long in there. They will manage it for you, and you'll be much better protected. Now, be careful. Believe it or not, organized crime groups have actually created their own password managers and put them into the app stores. So they would love to have access to all of your passwords. The other thing that you can do to protect yourself is turn on what is called two-factor authentication. Though you may not realize it, companies like Google for Gmail, Facebook, Dropbox, PayPal, they all will allow you to create two-factor authentication. What that means is that in addition to your password, they can send you a secret code via SMS text to your mobile phone, which is a one-time password, only good for 5 minutes. And then this way, if hackers in Russia or China or Brazil get access to your account, if they don't have that one-time password SMS that shows up on your phone, then they can't get in. And just those two steps alone will go a long way to protect you.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone to another Mark in Fort Worth. Hi, Mark.
Hey there. Thanks. Great show today, as usual.
Thank you.
Okay, so I don't want to be completely paranoid now by looking at my iPhone, nor do I want to be a conspiracy theorist, but I have heard about remote access to cameras on devices and being able to spy that way. Is that true? Should I go back to my flip phone?
Well, if you don't want your smartphone to be hacked, that would be one way to go, or a landline or smoke signals or something else. But in reality, all of those things can be hacked. What people don't realize is how many different devices around us are becoming computers, right? Mark Andreessen, the founder of Netscape, famously said that software is eating the world. Maps used to be pieces of paper. They're now GPS devices. You know, CDs used to be for music. Now it's all streaming online. Our movies on DVDs are now Netflix. So every physical object in our space, even the old telephone, which used to be a mechanical dial device, is now becoming a computer. And so that's something that people don't get, whether it be your DVR, your refrigerator, your automobile, an airplane, an elevator. An elevator is a computer we ride in. A car is a computer we ride in. An airplane is a Solaris box that we fly in. And a pacemaker today is a computer we implant in our bodies. And the FBI director famously said, Mueller, that there are only two types of computers, those that have been hacked and those that will be. So back to your specific question on cameras. Yes. Cameras on your laptops can be hacked. Cameras in your home can be hacked. Security cameras can be hacked. And even the ones on your mobile phone can be hacked. I tell the story in Future Crimes of a young lady called Cassidy Wolf. She's 16, 17 years old. She was Miss Teen America. And one day she got an email in her inbox that contained 30 or 40 pictures of herself naked walking around in her own bedroom, and she couldn't imagine what was going on. Attached to those photos was a demand. Somebody said, you have to have sex with me on Skype, or I'm going to share all of these photos with your friends on Facebook and post them on the internet. Of course, she went hysterical crying, slammed down the laptop, and she told her mom. And fortunately, they called the FBI, and what they learned, it was one of her classmates who had hacked her. And the interesting thing about it, two interesting things, is number one, we think that, well, if our camera's on, we'll see the little green light or we'll see the little red light. But the hacker software that's out there can turn those off. So here you had a girl who turns out she was coming out of the shower, you know, toweling off, getting ready for school, and she happened to have had her laptop open. And the hackers were able to turn that on remotely and grab those photos. There are also photos online and stories online of baby cameras, nanny cameras being hacked. Even casinos have had their camera systems hacked. There's a great story in Future Crimes talking about the Crown Casino in Australia. And the book kind of at points reads a lot like, you know, Ocean's 11 or Ocean's 13. Organized crime group in Asia went in. They sent a guy into the casino. He played poker for 24 hours, and he walked out of the casino with $33 million. The casino was flabbergasted. They had no idea what happened. And as it turns out, before he went into play, his organized crime group hacked the security cameras in the casino, which were above every card table, and they could see the cards that the dealer had, and they were talking into a hidden microphone into their criminal, you know, criminal co-conspirator's headset, so he knew when to play, when to hold them, when to fold them, and just using that one simple camera hack walked away with $33 million. So we think cameras are there to protect us, but they can also be hacked and used against us.
I don't think of myself as being especially paranoid or full of anxiety about new technology, but I will say the reports that we heard a week or two ago about drones flying around the Eiffel Tower in Paris, and of course there was a drone that was at the White House. These things, they could just have cameras, although that can be problematic. They can have weapons. What do we need to do to keep these under control, and is this a matter of laws or a matter of controlling the technology in some way?
Yeah, that's a great question. By the way, just for your caller who asked questions about hacking cameras, super simple thing that you can do to protect yourself. Put a Band-Aid over your camera. Take a Stick-It, put it over your camera. Put a piece of black electrical tape over your camera and take it off when you want to use it. Very simple. That's one of the tips that I have in Future Crimes. Remember when I said there are simple things you can do to protect yourself? Some of them are really simple, and they will completely avoid those problems.
Makes perfect
now
sense.
Now to the questions of drones. So up until now, the cyber threat, as we have understood it, has always been a two-dimensional problem. This is one of the key points of Future Crimes, is that up until now, we have had our screens hacked. We've had ones and zeros move around on our computer so that we lost our identity, so that our credit card was taken over, so that somebody was able to do a tax scam against us. All of that's on computer screens. But now, as you pointed out, when you talk about drones, computers are coming into the real world through robotics, whether they be robotic vacuum cleaners, whether they be drones, whether it be self-driving cars. All of that technology are robots, and robots are nothing more than computers that crawl, roll, fly, and even swim. And so we're going to have a lot more robots around us, and those robots, too, are hackable. And as you pointed out in the case in Paris, or what happened at the White House when a drone crash landed on the lawn there, it's going to pose new threats for us. The cybercrime threat that's always been a two-dimensional threat is about to become a three-dimensional threat. You know, and we've seen what happens in the Middle East, both in Iraq and Afghanistan. The U.S. has a very sophisticated drone and robotics fleet, and thousands of people have been killed by armed robots. And we will certainly see criminals starting to do that. We've already seen examples out of Boston where the FBI disrupted a plot of a young kid at Northeastern University, an Al-Qaeda affiliate of Bangladeshi descent, who was going to use remote-controlled jet aircraft 1/20th scale and fly them laden with explosives into both the Capitol and the Pentagon. We're also seeing that we have new ways of spying on people. There's a great case in Seattle that occurred a couple of months ago where a woman was on the 26th story of her apartment building. There were no apartment buildings around her. She, too, would come out of the shower and change with the curtains open. And one day she saw a drone hovering outside of her 26th story apartment, taking pictures of her in HD to keep that footage. footage of her completely naked. Now, you can imagine calling the Dallas or Fort Worth police department to say, hey, we've got a problem here. But they don't have drone fleets, right? And they don't have a way to respond to that. And, of course, drug dealers, too, are using these. There was a report that just a few weeks ago where a quadcopter drone, something that you could buy basically at Radio Shack or Best Buy or Costco, right? They're becoming really cheap, just a few hundred bucks. Dope dealers were using those to fly 12 pounds of methamphetamine across the Mexican border into the United States. And the reason why the drone crashed is because the drone was only rated for 6 pounds of meth. So they overloaded the drone with too much meth and it crashed on the border. So we will see a variety of new challenges around these. And currently it's the FAA that regulates the airspace from a security perspective. But there was a study done by the GAO that pointed out that there is no element of federal government today that is responsible for maintaining privacy in drones. And is it legal for somebody to fly a drone over your backyard? Is it legal for somebody to fly a drone outside your 26-story window? The law is really unclear on that point. And, you know, we want to be secure in our homes and our papers, but we're definitely going to need some public policy and law to deal with this. And we're a long way off at the moment.
So do you feel like lawmakers are just behind the curve in understanding the potential for harm?
Yes, I think very, very broadly, yes. Congress has about a 9% approval rate, 9 to 13%, depending on what month. And the majority of our Congress is made up of attorneys and lawyers. And those people tend not to be technologists. Whereas if you compare it to what's going on in China in their Communist Party Standing Committee, of the 10 members they have, I think 9 or 10 of them have PhDs in electrical engineering and, you know, physics, mathematics, hard sciences. And it's not that the lawmakers can't understand what a drone is, right? You can show them one. They've done demonstrations on the floors of Congress with drones. Is that they don't understand the potential. And when they bring up regulation, the concern is that they might over-regulate, right? There are lots of farmers in Texas and elsewhere that would love to have access to a $300 or $500 drone that they could use for crop dusting, right? That will be the new way that crop dusting is done. And there'll be lots of really cool reasons for it, you know, whether it's delivering a pizza or Amazon delivering your packages. So we don't want to stifle innovation, but we need to understand that there are some threats and there are definitely some holes in our law that the bad guys are fully ready to exploit at the moment.
Mark Goodman is with us. He's founder of the Future Crimes Institute. He's worked as a police officer, senior advisor to Interpol, and futurist in residence for the FBI. We're talking about his new book, Future Crimes: Everything is Connected, Everyone is Vulnerable, and What We Can Do About It. We'll come back to the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think if you'd like to participate, or you can email think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can learn to draw and paint, how to speak French, or plan for your retirement. Courses start each week through spring. Registration and information is at smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Future Crimes Institute founder Mark Goodman. His new book is Future Crimes: Everything is Connected, Everyone is Vulnerable, and What We Can Do About It. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Mark, we're 43 minutes in and we haven't even touched biotech yet. Certainly there's a lot in the book that is disturbing with regard to this. You know, it's scary enough to think in the past that somebody could get a hold of some, you know, horrible pathogen and deliberately spread it. Now it may be possible in the very near future to synthetically create something in a lab that we have no vaccine against and no natural immunity to.
Well, as you point out, synthetic biology definitely is a growing concern in future crime. And by the way, it's not just a concern. It's also going to be a tremendous boon to the world. So for those who may not be familiar with the technology, right, we've made tremendous advances in genetics, and we will have a radical extension of life as a result of genetic research. So broadly, this is a tremendous good for society, big advances in genetics, the opportunity and potential to come up with cures for cancer and even personalized cancer treatments, right? Because each one of our tumors is unique. They grow differently. They respond differently to medicines. And right now, the broad-based approach has just been sort of chemotherapy or radiation, which is really horrible and ineffective broadly. I mean, it does some good, but it's not the best tool. So now researchers are looking at, well, how can we personalize our cancer treatments just for you and just for your tumor? And so advances in genetics and biology are making that possible. What people may not understand is that biology is just another information technology. We used to think of it as existing in petri dishes and test tubes and laboratories, but now we have a total integration of modern biology with information technology. So you can take those cells, you can take DNA, genetics, and represent them on a computer screen. So there was something called the Human Genome Project at the turn of the last century that went ahead and decoded the human genome for the first time ever. Once you have those individual base pairs on a computer, you can rearrange them in really interesting ways. You can rearrange them for therapeutic purposes to help cure disease, but you can also rearrange them for more nefarious purposes, as you mentioned, such as bioweapons. I'll give one example in the case of, you know, the avian influenza, the bird flu. It's kind of hard to get, but once you get it, it has a fairly high mortality rate. The reason why when we have outbreaks, only 2,000 or 3,000 people die is because its transmissibility is low. But there were a bunch of researchers, both in the United States and the Netherlands, that wanted to publish a paper that said, hey, we figured out why the transmissibility of avian influenza is low. And if you just move around these few base pairs and proteins in it, we can radically improve the transmissibility of this deadly disease, which means that we would not just have 2,000 or 3,000 people killed, but a global pandemic where 20 million people could be killed. And it's not to cause panic. Again, most of this technology will be inured to the public good, but we need to understand that there are also some risks out there. And the U.S. government went against those researchers and said, hey, please don't publish this. This is dangerous. They claim First Amendment. And in the end, happily, they ended up publishing an amended version of their research, because if the research is freely out there, those tools to do synthetic biology, you know, various machines and computers that used to cost tens of millions of dollars can now just cost a few thousand. So the great news is there are biohacking classes going on in high school, and there are robotics classes going on in high school. And most of that innovation is going to be awesome. And our kids will learn things that we never knew and that we never thought were possible. But with it, we all know in society there are always a few bad apples. And the challenge that we need to confront is that those bad apples are getting access to some awesome tools to do good and awesome tools to do evil. And one of the meta thoughts and theses behind Future Crimes is, now is the time to prepare. We have wired this world, but we failed to connect it. We're going to be adding 200 billion new devices to our global information grid by 2020, according to Intel, the computer company. We can't even protect what we have online today. So as we bring on new tools and techniques like robotics, artificial intelligence, nanotech, synthetic biology, Internet of Things, 3D printing, now is the time to think about how we're going to deal with those threats. And the good news is there's a lot that we can do, and I outline in over several chapters the steps that we can take to have that better future that we all want and to enjoy our technological tools.
Can we crowdsource the policing and prevention of tech crimes?
Absolutely, we can. And I can tell you the bad guys are crowdsourcing all the time. For those of you who don't know, you know, crowdsourcing is when you put something out on the internet and try to get a bunch of people to do it. You know, flash mobs are a bunch of people show up downtown and start singing and dancing. It's pretty fun. They put it up on YouTube. But you can crowdsource everything from website design to, you know, building a house, right? There's lots of tools and techniques for crowdsourcing, and bad guys are using that too. And I'll give you some great examples, and then I'll talk about law enforcement crowdsourcing. Here's a great example that occurred in Seattle. A man walked into a bank in downtown Seattle, handed the teller a note and pointed a gun at her and said, "This is a stick-up. Give me all your money." He robbed the bank, ran out of the bank, and when he did that, the teller dialed 911 immediately. The cop said, "What does the bank robber look like?" And they said, "Oh, he's a male white. He's about 6'1". He had on a construction helmet, construction goggles, a orange construction worker vest. He had a tool belt and blue jeans and boots, and he ran out. The cops said, "Great, we're on our way." They showed up at the bank robbery, and there, lo and behold, they saw the guy 200 feet outside away from the bank, and they grabbed him. They said, "Put your hands up." They took him into custody. Then a moment later, another police car came, and they saw another construction worker who they took into custody, and then again and again and again. And before you knew it, the cops had 20 construction workers in custody. What the heck had happened? Turns out our bank robber, before he decided to carry out the bank robbery, put an ad on Craigslist saying, "Hey, I'm looking for construction workers. Show up at the corner of such and such downtown at 11 a.m., which just happened to be right next to the bank." He said, "I will pay $50 an hour cash, and you must have your own equipment. You must have your own worker safety goggles. You must have your own helmet. You have to have an orange safety vest, a tool belt, boots, and blue jeans." Mm-hmm. And so 50 people showed up thinking that they were there for work. And in effect, he crowdsourced his escape and brought all of these innocent people into bank robbery. So, by the way, don't do this at home, kids, in case you get the idea to do that. It's still very much illegal and a felony. But the bad guys are all over these techniques. So to your question about us crowdsourcing law enforcement, we have done that in the past, and we've kind of moved away from it. If you think about the old U.S. Marshal, you know, wanted posters that used to appear in the post office, the idea of, you know, Texas Rangers, of U.S. Marshals, that was crowdsourced law enforcement, the people coming together to protect themselves. We have a reserve corps in the U.S. Army with the Marines, the Air Force, and the Navy. They're reserve police officers. But the problem is that we do not have a National Reserve Cyber Corps. And I think that we need one, because we are going to face a very large cyber threat in the future, right? We're just wiring too much of this world insecurely. And when that happens, we're going to need all hands on deck, right? FEMA can deal theoretically with the natural disasters that we have. But there's no organ of the U.S. government that is really well equipped, especially the Department of Homeland Security, to go ahead and help out with these various cyber risks. So we need to bring in a whole bunch of talented people from the private sector. It could be from NGOs, startups, high school students, college students, senior citizens. All you need to do is understand technology. Let's get them involved. Let's get them background clear, know who they are, so that we have this reserve corps ready and we can get out there and start crowdsourcing our own security, because at the end of the day, it's too important to leave to the professionals. We need to do it ourselves.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak on the phone now with Louie in Dallas. Hello, Louie.
Hey, how's it going, Chris?
Great, thanks.
Yeah, I just wanted to call and kind of touch on the subject of drones. I am in the process, like many others in North Texas, trying to start a drone startup company here. And if we're focused on, and if the government's focused on outlawing technology, that doesn't change the human element of how things get used. And to talk about security and the wrong and right decisions that get made on there, there was a kid, I believe under the age of 18, who was flying his drone around the Trinity River and captured a pig farm that was dumping blood into the Trinity River. That information got turned in, they got fined. And then what did the pig farming industry do? They turned around, hired lobbyists, redefined what an image is, and you can find this this language in the Texas House Bill 912 that passed, I believe, in 2013. So, one, if we are worried about securities, how are we also worried about how they're handled as far as when it gets to the courts and they're prosecuted? And actually, that's really it, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
I think the caller raises a really good point, and I want to be really clear. I am not anti-technology. I'm not anti-drone. I think there's going to be tons of good uses for these. You talked about a local example there that I was unfamiliar with the pig farmers, but I will tell you, we have our first recorded case of a drone saving a life. The drone was operated by the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, the Mounties. They were looking for somebody whose car went off the road. They went into a snowbank. They couldn't find them, and there was way too much territory to cover, and it was actually a quadcopter drone operated by the Mounties that found the person and saved their lives. So these technologies can be awesome. And I would disagree on one point is I think we do need to talk about security, right? We can't just say, oh, we're going to ignore the security implications of it and then be surprised when a drone, you know, is used by a terrorist to attack a building. Again, that is a rare example, but if it does occur, the damage could be really significant. So we just need to be prepared. And these are the exact type of conversations that we should be having, weighing the good against the bad and getting the people involved to help inform the lawmakers on this particular case.
The book makes it clear how easy it is to access someone's DNA and completely sequence someone else's DNA without their permission or even their knowledge. My question is, what does somebody want with that information?
So we were talking before about some of the challenges of passwords and how, you know, the password error is over and many people are pushing for biometrics, that is measuring the physical characteristics of your body or your human self as a means of identifying you to a computer system. So that could be fingerprints, iris scans. It could also even be your DNA. And so there may be a time in your future when your DNA is actually how you authenticate. The challenge is that the first time we decoded the human genome, it was a $3 billion affair. That's how much the U.S. government spent on it. Now you can do a full human genome sequencing for about $1,000. And in the next few years, it'll be $10. So the ability to take somebody's genetic material and use it against their will without their knowledge is going to be kind of scary, if I were to be honest, right? How does this play out? Well, let's say that you're involved in a paternity suit, right? There are all different labs out there that do what they call clandestine DNA analysis, where you take a hair from somebody's comb or their toothbrush or a tissue that they sneezed into, and you send it off to a lab and you confirm paternity. But there are other things that you could do as well. There was a study I cite in Future Crimes where a bunch of researchers from Israel were able to capture somebody's DNA, their genetic material. They were basically able to put it in a DNA synthesizer and grow it at scale, and then they could leave that person's DNA at the scene of a crime. And when the cops showed up, they found the DNA evidence, and it looked as if it had come from somebody who had never been there. So DNA, something that had always been exculpatory, can now become inculpatory, and innocent people can be framed. So we're going to see lots of different challenges around DNA in the future. And again, overall, great technology will save thousands and thousands of lives, but we just need to understand the flip side because the bad guys are always there. That's the point, I guess, of Future Crimes, and what I wanted your audience to understand is I'm telling these stories. They're amazing. They're innovative. They're cool. It's like, you know, the Craigslist bank robber. You think, wow, criminals are so inventive. And it's meant to be a good, fun read. But the ultimate purpose of this certainly is not to scare people. I have no interest in scaring people or fear-mongering. What I'm trying to do is share with you, based upon my own research, stuff that the bad guys are already doing against you. When I was a cop, on the side of my police car, I used to say protect and serve. And I took that oath very seriously. I'm trying to serve and be of service so that folks know what the bad guys are up to, how they're coming after you. And if you have that knowledge, you will be empowered. If I told you not to walk down a particular dark alley, you would say, oh, well, you're scaring me. But if I knew that there had been robberies in that neighborhood, then I would be helping you and protecting you. And so we can do this. We can solve this problem. It sounds insurmountable, but if we go back to the 1960s, right there in Texas, President Kennedy gave a speech where he said, by the end of this decade, we will put a man on the moon. We did that, right? Our human species, we Americans, we did that. We put a man on the moon. And if we can do that, surely we can solve this cyber threat. But we're going to have to be much more intentional about it. We're going to have to get off our butts. We're going to have to demand more from government. And if we do that, if we take back control of our own tech and don't give it up to others, whether it be criminals, corporations, terrorists, or even our own government, if we take back control of our own tech, then our future can be incredibly bright. And that's what I'm looking forward to.
Mark Goodman is founder of the Future Crimes Institute. He's worked as a police officer, senior advisor to Interpol, and futurist in residence for the FBI. His new book is called Future Crimes: Everything is Connected, Everyone is Vulnerable, and What We Can Do About It. Mark, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
Thank you, Chris. The pleasure was mine.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Kristen Taylor. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter. I'm at Chris Boyd Think. If you want to contact the show via email, that address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.